Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Welcome to NPR News Presents. I'm Stephen John. This hour, it's the third program in this fall's Talking Volumes series. Gloria Steinem is an activist, journalist, and women's rights leader. She's out with a new memoir called My Life on the Road. Last night, she joined Talking Volumes host Carrie Miller on the stage at a sold-out Fitzgerald Theater.
You had that realization about the collective power of bringing people together in a room when you went on the road with activist Florence Kennedy, right? And you were going to college campuses, and you were realizing what it meant to have young women and young men who cared about the women's movement in a room together. Tell me a little bit about that time and that experience.
Well, first of all, you talk about nervousness. I only spoke together with another woman because I couldn't do it by myself. And I only spoke in the first place, even with another woman, because I wasn't able to get published what I wanted to say about the then, you know, just first burgeoning, exciting women's movement. And my editors were, shall we say, not interested. Okay. So
you were pitching your editors stories about what was happening with the women's movement out in the country. And they were saying nobody cares about that, or?
Yeah. It was either very stereotyped coverage or they weren't interested. And at the same time, because I had been writing for the then new New York Magazine, I was getting invitations to talk about the women's movement. So I realized that it was the only way that I was going to be able to say what this excitement was about. I was feeling like it's giving me life and giving all of us life, and it made such sense. And the only way I could do that was to get somebody else to do it with me, a very brave woman like Flo Kennedy.
So she would go on first, and she would kind of...
She went on first because after her, I would be an anticlimax, okay? I mean, she was so great. Does anybody here remember Flo? Oh, thank you. Because in those days, for instance, somebody in the back in the South especially would say about a white woman and a black woman speaking together, are you lesbians? And Flo would say, are you my alternative?
She took no prisoners.
Which is
right?
Like the perfect answer, right? Because it didn't, you know, right.
What do you think she taught you about activism?
Oh, she taught me so much. In the beginning, I thought you had to prove everything about discrimination, so I was full of facts and figures and everything. And she drew me aside one night, and she said, honey, if you're lying in the ditch with a truck on your ankle, you do not send somebody to the library to find out how much the truck weighs. You get it off, right? Okay.
How did your shtick change after that? Because I assume it did.
Well, it did, yeah, because I realized that our brains are organized on narrative. You know, we haven't been sitting around campfires for 100,000 years or more for nothing, right? And facts and generalities are fine, but if you tell me or you, one, we'll make up a story as to why it's true. So you need a narrative in order to involve people, and so I began to learn that that was what was important.
I mean, this is still, obviously, this is still true.
Yes.
I mean, the way you've told the stories in this, the way we listen and learn from one another, and as I mentioned, the experience that we have collectively in a room together. I mean that's changed the way I think about what we do.
Well, it's actually literally scientifically true, because I asked my friendly neurologist in New York whether we could produce oxytocin. You know, it's a hormone, the so-called tend and befriend hormone, that male or female, if we hold a baby, we're flooded with oxytocin.
The bonding hormone?
Bonding. If we see a member of the human race in deep trouble and danger, we feel an impulse to help, even if we don't know that person. I mean, without this, I think the species would not survive, right? So I said to her, you know, do we produce oxytocin on the page or the screen? And she said, no, actually. We need to be together, as we are, with all five senses. And you can't raise a baby on the web, you know.
The moral of that story.
Right. So even though, you know, I mean, I love books, I'm a writer, and so on. So the gift of following the fear, you might say, the fear I had of public speaking, I got to be in my mid-30s without ever speaking in public. I was devoted. I had been two things, a dancer and a writer, both because I didn't want to talk. Okay. The gift that doing it anyway, you know, they used to say, follow the fear. Fear is a sign of growth, you know. The gift that it gave me was you, you know, because I realized, wait a minute, you know, something does happen when we're in the same space that can't happen any other way. And I think it's important now because it's part of the reason that people can be cruel to each other on the web in a way that probably would not be so easy like this.
Yeah, it's also part of the reason that you still do this. You're still on the road. I mean, as you say, I think at the beginning of the memoir, people say to you, you're still traveling?
No, the word still, I would say after 60, the word still entered my life.
Right? About a lot of things,
yeah,
or just traveling?
Oh, you're still wearing blue jeans. Oh, you're still... Yeah.
And does a woman of a certain age get used to that and learn how to deal with that, or what?
Yeah, you know, I mean, age is so weird, isn't it? I mean, because I'm still dealing with my own age bias. You know, because
are you?
Sure, because I'm 82 years old, and I... But, you know, who thinks about, I mean, you know those Russian dolls, you know, with this, the little, okay, I think we're all like those Russian dolls, the six-year-old and this, if ever, right? So I hear somebody else is 82, I think, oh, that's over the hill. They say, no, I'm 82.
What does over the hill mean today, do you think?
I think it could only come about by conscious decision. Because there is no over the hill. If you're living in the present, you're living in the present. And we are that Russian doll with all the internal differences that we've ever known. And I guess, you know, that's the real secret of aging. You're still the same person, you know?
So when you have that kind of late realization, wait a minute, I'm in my early 80s, how do you think of yourself day to day? And maybe it's not.
Well,
a specific
I don't.
Age,
I mean, I'm not thinking about myself today. I'm thinking, oh, I'm mad about that. I should do something. And if I send that email, maybe somebody. You know, I mean, you're thinking about all these other things. You know, you're not thinking. I don't know how to explain it.
You're thinking
about content, not form. You know, right?
Well, okay. So I interrupted you. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, I, you know, for instance, here's an example. When I'm writing, I want to tell other people what I've seen. So I'm doing that. And then I realize, because we need narrative, that I have to go back and put myself in. Otherwise, I'm saying what I've seen and observed as a reporter, you know, and that's one kind of story. But you need to have somebody who represents you there. And, you know, Alice Walker, the writers I love do that. But I don't find it so easy to do the first time. I have to go back and put myself in.
I want to ask you to tell the story that's at the beginning of Revolution, where you show up at the Plaza Hotel. This will give us a sense of how dramatically things have changed just in your career, I hope. You show up at the Plaza Hotel to interview, is it a celebrity?
Mm-hmm.
A male celebrity.
Yes, I was then a freelance writer, and so I was working for the on assignment once in a while for the Sunday New York Times. And they had sent me to interview an actor who was staying at the Plaza Hotel. Okay, so I was sitting in the lobby waiting for him. And the head of the busboy, I don't know, some official of the hotel came over and said, you know, sorry, no single women or women by themselves allowed in the lobby. And I, you know, thought, oh, God, do I look like a, you know, I'm a working girl, a prostitute, you know. And so
that's what he thought you were, right?
Yeah, clearly. And so I stood just outside the glass door hoping to see the person I was supposed to interview, and I didn't. And I missed the interview, and my editor was mad, and the agent of the actor was mad, and everybody was mad. And then just a couple of weeks later, there was a demonstration outside the Oak Room, which then served only men at lunch because they said female voices would disturb men doing serious business. You can't make this stuff up. And a group of early feminists had demonstrated, you know. And that, just that, changed something in my head. And then by accident, I had an assignment to interview another actor, right? Also in the Plaza Hotel. So I'm sitting there, and the same guy came over and said to me, you know, you have to leave and everything. I said, look, you know, how do you know, you know, how do you know the men here are not prostitutes? They could be prostitutes. And besides that, you probably just get a cut of the women you call to... Therefore, you know, I mean, I put up this...
So you accused him of being a pimp.
Right.
Just so we're clear about what
was
going on.
And he let me stay.
Here.
And he let me stay, and I interviewed the guy. It was different, you know. So it's just the change in consciousness. I'm sure we've all experienced that, right? It's just... and that's what we give each other, and that's the gift of a movement.
Here's the other thing. Here's the other thing, though. I sense that that is still happening to you... Often.
Yes.
You're right. Still, I mean...
Isn't it happening to all of us? I mean, yeah, right, right.
But you have to be awake for that, right? You have to be awake and receptive to that.
Well, I think we have to see an example of somebody who strengthens us. You know, that makes a big difference, a big difference. I mean, here's another example. People call you names, right? And one day I saw a woman who was being called a bitch, and she said, thank you. And ever since then, I've said, thank you. Right? I sort of don't know what to do with it, you know. Sorry.
I like it. You've been called a bitch a few times?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, really? You've also been called the Ivan Boesky of Nookie, an oversexed spinster... A man-izer, sticks and stones, right? How did you learn to deal with that, though?
Well, you know, those are so bizarre. No, I mean, I worry more when... What hurts more is when those of us who are really trying to do similar things feel that I or someone else or, you know, have not... done it the right way, if you know.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, maybe we've not been inclusive enough in the way we write or speak, or maybe it's, you know, it's hard to think of a specific, but I think what hurts the most is when we who are in the same movement criticize each other. It hurts more, right? Than you. I mean, you know, if Rush Limbaugh liked me, I would know there was something seriously wrong that I was doing.
You address this, I think, in the memoir that there has been and there still remains a perception that the women's movement was really about middle-class white women who were comfortable enough economically that they could afford to be involved in the movement.
No, that drives me up the wall, absolutely, right. Because, you know, we all have different experiences. Maybe that is somebody's experience, but it's not the majority experience, I don't think. Because, for instance, in an early issue, Ms. Magazine commissioned a Lou Harris poll, a big national poll, and about the women's movement and specific issues internal to the women's movement. And it turned out that over 60% of African-American women supported the movement and those issues, and only about 30% of white women did. And that reflects my perhaps accidental personal experience, which is that I kind of learned feminism disproportionately from women who were in the National Welfare Rights Organization because they'd done this, the first feminist analysis of social policy I'd ever seen about welfare as a gigantic husband who, you know, they look for your other men's shoes under your bed and they, you know, give you just enough money to survive. It was hysterical. It was very funny, their analysis. Or Flo Kennedy and my other, and Margaret Sloan and Dorothy Pittman Hughes, those were all my early speaking partners. They're all African-American women. And Shirley Chisholm, you know, who by herself took the black, took the white male-only sign off the White House door all by herself, and I ran as her delegate when she was running for president. It just felt to me so wrong, because if you say it's a white middle-class movement, maybe that's somebody's experience somewhere, but it wipes out, it renders invisible all the women of color, and especially African-American women, who were there, and by and large, disproportionately, I don't mean to overgeneralize, but in my experience, disproportionately ahead.
You know, I think there are some young women that still believe that. I did a show not too long ago about millennials and feminism, which is something I want to talk to you about. And several young women called to say, that movement wasn't about me, and the movement today is not about me. We need a different movement.
Well, I don't know where it comes from, and everything is true somewhere, so I'm not saying my experience is... but it's troublesome. And actually, and I'm together with a couple of women, Beverly Guy-Sheftel, perhaps you know her, who was, she's at Spelman, and she was the head of the Women's History. Anyway, we're so mad, finally, that we're just writing a book called Black Women Who Invented Feminism and listing a whole bunch of it. Because it just...
Oh, you're working on that now?
Yeah.
Oh,
no,
good.
It renders people invisible. It just doesn't make sense. I think some of it is on purpose, to divide and conquer. You know, some of it is true. You know, it's a white middle class country, but some of it is on purpose.
Let's come back to younger women and the idea of feminism in a minute, but what about the idea that the movement of when it was beginning, and you were so involved in it, was really about being anti-man? I mean, that was a... I think there were people, again, who felt like that was a good way to knock down the movement.
Well, I mean, it was always both to say... I mean, you know, it's like, you know, the civil rights movement was seen as being anti-white. It's not anti-white. It's just talking about, hello, here I am, and this is supposed to be a democracy. And women were not being anti-male. I think they were seen as that because of male privilege or dominance. And if you oppose, you know, if what's normal is 60-40 and you propose 50-50, then they're mad at you because they think 60-40 is normal.
But there were women who believed that too.
Yeah, but it was...
The late Phyllis Schlafly being one of them, right?
I don't know what she believed. I really don't.
Really? How much interaction did you have with her?
Really none.
She's puzzling.
Really none. I mean, she was totally on her own, you know. She was just out there on her own, right.
Getting a lot of media time, right?
Yeah, because I think, I'm not sure, but I think that she was assigned, you know, there weren't that many women in the John Birch Society. And so I think they needed a woman to oppose the women's movement. And in a way, because she was really way more interested in military policy than in the women's movement, but I think maybe she was assigned to us, so to speak.
She came and demonstrated every day, right, of the women's convention in Houston.
No, she didn't demonstrate. What she did was the women's convention in Houston, which is the most important event nobody knows about, you know, and maybe people here remember when over a two-year period, delegates and issues were elected in every state, including, obviously, Minnesota. And then the delegates and the possible issues went to Houston. It was huge. It was like a constitutional convention for women. It was huge. And what Phyllis Schlafly and Bob Dornan, does anybody remember Bob Dornan?
Oh, yeah.
A terrible guy, congressman from...
From Georgia?
No, where, California.
Oh, California.
Yeah. So in order to counter us, you know, this is a huge Democratic, you know, representative by ethnicity and class and huge. And so they organized a conference just on the spot and declared it equal to ours on the other side of town. And I'm sorry to say that the false equivalency that we are now seeing in our presidential election.
We'll get to that later.
The false equivalency caused a lot of the media to cover that completely unelected, completely undemocratic conference equally to ours. Right. And that was very frustrating.
You say at the end of that undertaking, the conference in Houston, that you wondered whether anybody would know about it, care about it in the years to come. And you just said that it's one of the most important things for women mm-hmm. that most people don't know about. So why is that, do you think?
Well, it's the kind of, if it's about women, how important can it be? Then there was news in Israel that dwarfed our news. It's a series of things. But I think it's coming back. I mean, there are a couple of books being done about it. I cover it extensively and very personally in this book. You know, I think, you know, we will rediscover how important it was and is, because, first of all, it was really the only economically, ethnically, racially representative 2,000 delegates I've ever seen in this country, completely representative. Secondly, it brought the movement together on issues. So previous to that, say... discrimination against lesbians had been controversial, whether or not that was effeminate with some of the more conservative women, but people vote, or reproductive rights and abortion had been, but it brought the movement together on the issues. It was really, really very important.
What do you think it changed in the immediate years after and even today?
Well, it was a Democratic, huge populist democratic process. And in those, it was led by Bella Abzug and Shirley Chisholm and Patsy Mink and a whole group of people. We actually got Congress to finance it. Can you imagine happening?
Yeah, no way.
I mean, they financed it like that, but still, you know. For instance, there was a representation of many different tribes and nations from Indian country. You know, that had never happened before. Everybody was there. Coretta Scott King. You know, I don't know. It was democracy at its best, I would say.
That's Gloria Steinem speaking last night at the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul in the Talking Volumes series. She's written a memoir titled My Life on the Road. More in a moment. This is NPR News Presents. Now back to Carrie Miller and Gloria Steinem at Talking Volumes. The event was held last night at the Fitzgerald Theater.
You still hear women say, and I'll bet there were some women in that Texas Women's University crowd, too, way back when, who would have said, I'm not smart enough to be a feminist. I don't know enough to be a feminist. I think you still hear women say it, and if they're not mm-hmm. saying it, maybe some are believing it. Do you?
It breaks my heart to hear that, because what it means is that somehow, I don't know whether it's gotten into academic language, you know, that people think...
What do you mean?
Well, you know, I'm always threatening to put a sign on the way to Harvard and Yale and so on that says, beware deconstruction ahead. Because feminism comes out of the lived experience of women, but sometimes in academic settings it can sound different, yeah, right? I think mostly not. I think we're quite populist usually. But it worries me. It breaks my heart. What do you mean? I don't know enough. I mean, I don't know enough to know that I'm a unique, full human being. You know, it hurts me.
I think what you said, we shouldn't miss that, that feminism comes out of the lived experience
of women. Right.
I don't know that we hear that often enough.
Well, of course it does. I mean, that's where, you know, every movement, I mean, the civil rights movement came in large part out of people in churches and other places in the South telling people, saying what happened to them and hearing what happened to other people and testifying, and women's movement sitting in our living rooms or wherever saying what happened to us, thinking we were alone, discovering other people had the same experience. So if unique people have the same experience, it's political, and if we get together, we can fix it. I mean, it is everything worthwhile, from trees to movements, is bottom up.
You were at a fundraising lunch earlier today, right? For Hillary Clinton?
No.
For who?
No, this was for the, wait a minute, call it out, for the...
Thank you.
Yeah.
You support Hillary Clinton?
Yes, I do, yeah.
You did, I know you know what I'm going to ask you. You did get in a little trouble in the primary season by saying that young women were...
I didn't say that.
Let's no. set the record straight, shall we?
You know, I was on a television show, Bill Maher show, and I was talking about how young women were mad as hell because they were graduating from college in debt and then earning $1 million less over their lifetime to pay it back. And then I was on my way to saying, and when you're young, you think, I was about to say power, you know, where the boys are, where the men are, is where the power is.
Ah.
And he interrupted at a point before I said power, so people thought it was that girls were motivated by dates, right? Politically motivated by dates.
So it sounded like you were saying young women are voting for Bernie Sanders because the boys are there.
Yeah, I've never noticed that you have to, you know, go get a campaign to get a date, no. No, if that's what I had meant, I would have been mad at me too, you know.
But say what you meant.
No, I meant that you know, when you're young, you think that where the power is where the boys are, where the men is, especially because Bernie was talking about free universal education. So, you know, I was on my way to saying that, but he cut me off, and it was probably a useful experience in the end because it was painful, but I discovered death by Twitter, you know, if this... You know, if there's only half a sentence and 14 words or something.
Right.
You know,
that's... 140 characters.
Yeah.
Are you on Twitter? I can't remember.
Yes.
But how can I not be following you?
I don't sit around and tweet.
You don't
I try to think
tweet?
Of Twitter as haiku. It somehow makes it open. Right.
So what do you do with Twitter, then, if you're not tweeting?
I just try to use it as a way of publicizing what should be publicized or commenting from time to time, but I don't sit in a movie and tweet about it, you know, right?
What do you think it is that still, and I see some indication that this is changing as we get towards the last 30 days of the campaign, but what...
But you know, back to this, the funny thing is that last week, Politico gave me... You know, they decided that thinking wrongly about what I said and what some other, I'm trying to think who else said, that we had said that gender was...
Was it Madeleine Albright?
Yeah, Albright.
They
right.
mashed up your two...
Right, the two things together. And so they gave us an award as being politically important.
Really?
So I put out on the way, I said, listen, you know, that isn't what I said. Don't give me an award for what I didn't say. It's weird, isn't it, that one thing can be you're criticized for and then somebody gives you an award for it and you still didn't say it?
I say take the award and the credit. Why not? I think what Madeleine Albright said, and she's been saying this for a long time.
She's been saying that for 40 years.
There's a special
place in hell for women who don't support other women. That does not mean that Madeleine Albright would vote for Sarah Palin. It...
Right.
I mean, it's not about, you know, it's about people who stand for the majority view and welfare and all the issues and so on. And then it's important that, you know, to know, say, that President Obama knows what it's like to be an African-American person for a lifetime walking around in this country. That's important. It's important that Hillary Clinton knows what it's like to be a female walking around. But it, that comes after the content. The form comes after the content. It's not form uber alles. Right?
I was going to ask you about why it is that you think young women, a certain percentage of them, don't feel at ease calling themselves feminists.
Well, because, I think there are two reasons. One is they don't know what it means. You know, and understandably, because Rush Limbaugh has been saying feminazi for 20 years, you know. So if you go to the dictionary and discover it just means somebody who believes in the full social, economic, political equality of males and females, they may change their mind. The other reason is they do know what it means, you know, and they don't agree. You know, they really feel deeply that they need male protection. And
young women and think income. This?
Yes, some do, yes. Absolutely. You know, but, you know, they're not immune from the culture that tells them that you're nothing without a man, you know. So, you know, it's a variety of reasons, but it is so small compared to what it used to be. I mean, now, you know, majority support for all of the issues of equality that we care about, and it didn't used to be that way at all. And young women are so activist and great. And the three young women who started Black Lives Matter, for instance. And, you know, all the, you know, the only way I can come up with explaining how I feel about young women is just to say, I had to wait for some of my friends to be born.
When did you, as you think back on your involvement in the movement, when do you feel like the change towards what you've just said, the majority of people believing in equality, where people began to take on the principles of the movement, even if they were not calling themselves part of the movement, when did that change?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to pinpoint, isn't it? But I would say toward the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, if you look at public opinion polls, these issues started to become... First of all, we didn't have words for a lot of the issues. You know, I mean, domestic violence was just called life. You know, we didn't have a term. We didn't have... laws, comes out of people just telling the truth about their lives and what happened, and sexual assault on campus, and, you know, and telling each other their salaries so they discover that actually they're not getting the same pay as the guy who's doing the same. Consciousness came from truth-telling, and it became a majority.
I have a quote from Deborah Tannen that kind of speaks to this, and I want to read it so I get it right. She says about younger women, the double bind lowers its boom on women in positions of authority. So those who haven't yet risen to such positions have not yet felt its full weight. You think that's right?
Well, yeah, probably, you know, because they haven't been in the workforce
right.
long enough, or they don't have kids yet, and they haven't discovered that somehow men are not taking care of kids as much as women yet, although many more men are. It's experience that radicalizes you. No, I agree. It takes a little time. And one thing I think is a mistake of us older women or men is to expect gratitude from young women. Because gratitude never radicalized anybody, okay? I did not walk around saying thank you for the vote. No, I got mad because of what was happening to me. So as much as I hope that we know our history, because it's very helpful to know that things aren't just given to you, that you have to organize and make them happen. Still, I worry that sometimes older women who worked so hard and battled so hard and had nobody to support them, and even their own families were against them and so on, now they're trying to exact gratitude from young women. It's not the fault of young women that they weren't supported at the time. You know, so I think it's a little, unfair.
What's wrong, though, with being grateful to you for having done the work that you've done, made some sacrifices, took some of the slings and arrows
for it? There's nothing wrong with it, but I think people who are grateful to you and me and lots of people in the audience for what we've done have already realized the necessity of it, if you know what I mean. Because otherwise, if you're... for instance, if you're graduating in debt, the same debt as the guy next to you, you may not yet know that you're going to earn $1 million less, as I was saying, to pay it back. That's what pisses you off.
Right.
Right. In addition to the debt.
I noticed that reproductive choice came up in the vice presidential debate. Has not been talked about very much in the...
No, it was so interesting because what got the most support was saying it's up to women to decide, right? And, and that was not mentioned by any of the commentators that I saw.
But it's also there hasn't been much of a discussion about it between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Well, I think Hillary Clinton has brought it up because Donald Trump has said that women should be punished for abortion and so on. And so on. She's brought it up, right?
Do you think he believes that?
You know...
This is a whole can of worms, isn't it? But let's go there. Let's open it. Do you think he believes that?
No. I think he says... says what is expedient or useful at the moment. I'm not sure that he's capable of talking about anybody but himself.
You know him, don't you?
No.
No? And even if you did?
I've seen him once in my life.
You live in New York. I figured y'all know each other. No.
I
thought there were circles that you moved in somehow.
Yeah. And... No, I'm not in those circles. I'm happy to say. But, the primary reason that people say they are for him is because he is a successful businessman and therefore he can run the country. So as somebody from New York, I just want to say he is not a successful businessman. He is a successful con man. If he had just invested the money he inherited, he would be richer than now. He has gone bankrupt so much and had, record numbers of lawsuits that he brings against everybody. He doesn't pay people. He exploits people. He is a protest candidate because nothing that he says actually checks out or is true.
But what does that tell you about...
Well, I think it tells us a variety of things that we need to think about. I mean, for instance, we are about to become... for the first time since Columbus, a country that is no longer majority European-American or white, right? This seems to me kind of great, because we're going to understand other countries better and it's going to be more diverse and interesting and better food and who knows. But if you've been raised to believe that you have a certain place in the hierarchy because you are white and because you're male, so you feel displaced by this. And I think that's... I mean, people who support Trump will sometimes look me in the eye and say, a black woman took my job. Okay. Now, what is wrong with that statement? Why is it his job? But that's privilege, right?
I was going to say, there's a real intersection in the lack of support that you saw over the years of the women's movement and the people who are supporting Donald Trump. Not all of them uneducated and unknowing about the political system, right? But feeling that slipping of privilege.
Yeah. And you know, they didn't invent the system they got born into, but they have been, and I don't mean to say about everybody, you know, but it feels as if they believe that they have a certain place of in society that is being displaced.
Right.
So the same groups, for instance, that are, you know, on campus, for instance, people will say to me, why are the same groups against lesbians and birth control? They sort of don't get...
Well, what is the answer to that? That is mysterious.
But it's because the belief system is that all sex is immoral unless it can end in childbirth, right? So, and the people who are worried about, you know, being displaced in a racial hierarchy will also say to me, you know, the white race is committing suicide by contraception and abortion and sex education and so on. And they're also against immigration because most immigrants are not white, right? So, you know, it's present, and Trump didn't invent it, but he is the... He is a protest candidate.
People say a lot of weird things to you, I just realized. I mean, why?
Well, it's not weird to them when they're saying it.
You've said at least, you know, 5 or 6 times, people will say to me, and then the weirdest thing comes out.
But it's not weird.
Do they think you're going to agree with them, or?
No, but they're explaining how they feel. A black woman took my job, you know.
And they think Gloria Steinem is going to say, damn right, do something. I mean, why are
they
telling
No, they know I'm
this?
Not going to say damn right, but they're saying how they feel. Right.
And they want you to hear that.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think we need, you know, nobody should take Trump seriously because he should be hospitalized rather than elected. But I think we need to take seriously the feeling of displacement and insecurity that the protest vote represents. And also there are some women supporting him. And again, as you know, we were saying before, you know, if you've been raised to believe that you can't succeed in the world without a strong male leading you and paying for you and so, you know, they didn't make that up. They internalized it. Right?
The political system, can it really address that sense of displacement and the vanishing privilege?
Yeah, no, I think it can.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think we're partly experiencing the punishment of a culture that has told us that if you are rich, you're smart. This has not been my experience. We've too much equated being rich with smartness, don't you think?
Well, Donald Trump says he's rich because he's smart.
He says he's smart because he's not paying his taxes. Oh, right. He zero taxes. He is riding around every day on highways that are paid for by tax money, drinking water that are paid for, being protected by cops that are, you know, it's ridiculous. Of course he should be paying taxes.
What do you think your friend Wilma Mankiller would make of this election? The late Cherokee Nation chief.
Yes.
Was a very good friend of yours.
Oy.
What do you think she'd say?
You know, I'd never understood how Wilma could take the fact that she knew she had come from a culture that was democratic, so democratic that the paradigm was a circle, not a pyramid, right?
Right.
That the Iroquois Confederacy of the Six Nations were the model for our Constitution, that women controlled their own bodies and decided when and whether to have children, that had, you know, this amazing, very advanced democracy, and then 90% of whom were destroyed, you know, as we know, by war and disease and so on. That it was such a superior culture in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of agriculturally, medically. And I it was so hard for me to understand how she could even survive herself, you know, with that kind of knowledge. And whenever I said that to her, she always said, "We're still here."
Is that one of the things that she, it seems like she was a teacher to you?
Absolutely. No, completely. Absolutely. And we were trying to write a book together before she died, and I don't know if I can get it, if I can do it without her or not.
If you can finish it?
Yes, because we were trying to take things from original cultures like Native American cultures, First Nations around the world, whether it's the Kwe and the San in Africa or the Dalits in India, or just trying to take practical things from those cultures that we could learn from. For instance, in one of the oldest cultures in Ghana, if someone does a destructive thing, an antisocial thing, they do indeed punish that person with isolation, for not like our solitary confinement, but a brief period of isolation, because we are communal animals. We need each other, so perhaps isolation is a universal punishment. But after the period of isolation, when that person came back into the group, there was a long ritual amount of time in which everyone who knew that person told them every good thing they had ever done.
Wow.
We could do that. We do the reverse. We punish people. We take away their votes, their jobs. You know, we continue to punish people. We understand positive reinforcement with kids, I think. You know, why not in every other, with human beings in general? Anyway, we were just trying to find practical examples from original cultures that we could learn from.
You have a lovely passage near the end of the memoir about being with Wilma Mankiller when she died, and then what happened in the days after. Would you read that?
Yes, it's so nice. You know, she selected these passages. Is that not great? I'm right. It's the beautiful Saturday morning of April 10th, 2010, and we are sitting outdoors at the Cherokee Cultural Grounds. Though it's only 4 days after Wilma's death, 150 tribal, state, and national leaders, including President Clinton and President Obama, have sent messages, and about 1,500 people have gathered to hear friends and family share personal memories. It's the best kind of memorial because each of us will leave knowing Wilma a little better than we did when we arrived. Among her last requests was that everyone wear or carry something in her improbable favorite color, bright pink. A symbolic drink made of strawberries is served. Strawberries are called ani in Cherokee and are supposed to help her make her way through the sky to her ancestors. For me, this is the beginning of years of picking up the phone and realizing I can't talk to her, of thinking about our book and knowing we can't write it together, of hearing something that would make her laugh, yet I can't tell her. My friend Robin Morgan, author of a lovingly researched novel about pagan times, has called to tell me that Wilma is being honored in many countries around the world as a great one. Pagan and native cultures share many beliefs, and one is that lighting signal fires at high points in the landscape will light the path of a great one home. As Wilma's friends put it, she is finally going to the other side of the mountain. At the end of my own tribute to Wilma, I tell the people gathered here in rural Oklahoma that in no fewer than 23 countries, signal fires have been lighted for Wilma and are now lighting her way home. Back at Wilma and Charlie's house, Charlie is her husband, Charlie carries out her last request, one she was and wasn't laughing when she made. She asked him to take the metal leg brace that she had to wear all the years after her car crash, place it in a field, and blast it with a shotgun. He does exactly that. It is now 5 years after Wilma's death, and I'm more than ever learning from and about original cultures on my own continent, in India, and in countries of Africa, where we all came from. Our current plight is not made inevitable by human nature. What once was could be again, in a new way. I once asked Wilma if one day my ashes could be with hers, and she said yes. In the future, they will be. Even though my ancestors were forced to escape their homes and come here, I feel I've found my land. If I could say one thing to Wilma, it would be this: we're still here.
I was wondering if there's any road, literal or figurative, that remains untaken for you.
To my desk.
To your desk?
Yeah, because, you know, movements, all the movements we care about so deeply, give you what you want to write about most and take away the time to write it. I hate to say this because I may not live up to it, but anyway, after this election, I hope to take the road home more.
Gloria, your activism and your idealism and your imagination are really inspiring. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to Carrie Miller's Talking Volumes event held last night before a capacity crowd at the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. Gloria Steinem has a new memoir called My Life on the Road. That's NPR News Presents for today, Monday at noon. You can hear a rebroadcast of the second presidential debate, which we will air live Sunday night.